We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Charles Goyette. He's a New York Times bestselling author and radio personality. He is known for his outspoken libertarian views and his economic commentary, and has been described as a fearless champion of liberty, peace, and prosperity. He's also co-author of The Last Gold Rush Ever with Bill Haynes, who we recently had on the show. Charles, how are you today?
Tom, it's so great to be on your program.
Thank you for joining us. So I'd like to start by addressing part of the title of the book. So what makes this the last gold rush or the last big gold bull market that we're facing today?
Yeah, thank you very much. We called it the last gold rush. We know that, there's a certain risk in doing that, people may think, they're going to have somebody's going to discover a new, mother lode somewhere, and we're all going to go buy picks and shovels. But it's not that kind of gold rush. This is a monetary gold rush. And the reason that we call it the last gold rush is that, having lived through a couple of prior huge gold bull markets, there is something qualitatively different about this one. And so that's what we've written about, and that's what we've tried to identify for the readers. And the basic thesis, Tom, is this, that all gold bull markets are generally driven by money printing, by a lot of government debt, by made up government money, unbacked money, fiat money. And all of your viewers are familiar with that. And those phenomena have driven the prior gold markets here in the United States, the one that topped out in 1980, the one that topped out in 2011. And they will certainly drive the one that we believe we are in today. But what is qualitatively different is that it's not just unprecedented levels of government debt and unprecedented levels of fiat money creation by the Fed. And it's not just that this is a global phenomena, that this is going on with the euro and it's going on everywhere. But there are other factors that haven't come to play in prior gold bull markets that will drive this one to, we think, astonishing new heights. And that's why we call it the last gold rush ever. We're already in the third version of the U.S. dollar in the last, let's say, 100 years. The first of those was a dollar that was really the gold dollar, and you could take a $20 gold bill and go to the bank, or go to the treasury, and they give you a $20 gold piece, and it was just a common thing. So the dollar at that time was a convenience, but it was a claim check for gold. And After 1933, it became illegal for Americans to own gold, but at least foreigners believed that they could take dollars and exchange them for gold. And that ended in 1971. So we had the gold dollar and then the gold exchange dollar. And now we have simply the dollar. And the dollar is the weakest of the three. It's not backed by anything. There is no restraint on the state or the central authorities for printing these. So this has all the characteristics of any normal bull market in gold, but it has all of these other factors coming to bear. And the best analogy I can make is to say that when the arson investigators investigate a fire someplace, they don't just look at the raw burning material, the fuel that burned the house or the building down, the wood framing and so on and so forth. They look at the accelerants. If it was arson, what drove the fire? Where was it spread? How fast did it spread? And so on. What are the signs? And we feel that in addition to the two basics of money printing and debt, we have a number of accelerants that will drive this gold market higher than anything we've experienced in our lifetimes.
So, Charles, could you kind of walk us through, like you said, there's the two main factors there, and then the other main accelerants, as you're calling it. So could you kind of give us an idea of what those are and how they're going to come into play?
Yeah, sure. So one of the biggest ones of all of the accelerants is the end of the American global military empire. And, like Rome before us and many empires before us, we are in a period of overstretch. We've made defense commitments to places that we can't afford. Our military spending goes up. And what happens is that we have so overstretched ourselves that the world is beginning to defy the United States diplomatically. And this is a great confusion to the administration. Secretary Mike Pompeo runs around the world. He tries to tell Germans, no, you can't buy cheaper fuel from Russia because, you know, we're sanctioning Russia and stuff. And they go, well, why should we pay more to buy from you? You know, and so they're defying U.S. Dictates. This hasn't happened in most of the post-World War II era. So the political leadership of countries, of empires, they look at defiance or a breakdown in their hegemony and their authority and people snapping to attention when they speak. And they think that that is a sign of weakness, and they need to respond to it by beefing up their military. And so the military budgets get much bigger and the defense commitments get bigger, and all of that ultimately drains resources from the domestic economy that makes people, you know, prosperous at home. And so we're in that kind of a battle right now. We've got the global military empire in a period of overstretch. The budgets have grown. They grow under Republicans. They grow under Democrats in the United States. The spending increases. And yet we are growing basically weaker and weaker and weaker. And it's because our real might doesn't come from the strength of our military and the number of troops we've got overseas. The real might of the United States has always been its economic might. But when we drain that economic might with money printing and with unpayable debt and stuff, the empire starts to crumble. So we didn't have this in the 2011 bull market. We didn't have this in the 1970s and 1980s gold bull market of the collapse. And the symptom of this, Tom, I think probably the most important symptom of this breakdown of America's reach or influence is in the dollar's status as the reserve currency of the world. And we have seen countries like Russia and China and many others moving pell-mell, and the reserves, their domestic reserves that they were once keeping in U.S. dollars, they've begun to transfer to gold. And Russia is a great example. They were a substantial creditor of the United States. They held about, I think they were probably close to $1 billion in U.S. treasuries they held. Now, when you go on the treasury report and look how many U.S. treasuries the Russian central bank holds, it's down in the asterisks. It's down, you know, with Iraq and Vietnam and stuff. They basically have gotten out. But in the meantime, they've moved that money they used to keep in dollars and moved it into gold. And China has done the same thing. China, until very recently, was the United States' number one creditor. And now they've slipped to number two. They have dishoarded, I would guess, about probably $300 billion in the last few years. So they're now number two creditor. They've probably dropped below $1 trillion. They used to hold about $1.3 trillion. So all of this is changing. In other words, we're not captains of our own fate or masters of our own soul here in the United States anymore. We're kind of dependent on the kindness of foreign lenders to keep our debt paid. And when they start to back away, as they have done, then we're in a real game-changing episode. So that's another one of the accelerants, and we do a deep dive into those topics in the book.
So does that point possibly towards going back to some type of a gold-backed currency for these types of countries, Charles?
Well, you know, I think it's clear that my view, Tom, is this, that the countries of the world, the central bankers, they aren't dummies. And no matter how I malign them in my writing and stuff, you know, some of them are very smart people and they know more or less what they are doing. And the Fed knows more or less what they're doing to the dollar, and they do know more or less what they're doing to the American people. And it's the same with the central bankers everywhere. So they don't mind. They may move more toward gold, and there are some visible movements for gold currencies or a gold basket, a basket of currencies containing gold. There are these visible movements that way. But for the most part, they don't mind, in my view, fleecing their own people with their own made-up fiat, unbacked printed money. They just don't want to be victimized by ours. And that's why they're moving out of dollars. They know what's coming with the U.S. dollar. And whether they want to restore gold to their own monetary systems remains to be seen. There's clearly some movement that way. And even if the nation states of the world don't do it, the world itself will do it with the failure of paper currencies like the dollar.
something we were discussing before the call here, Charles, was basically how Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve Board abolished the need for reserves. So can you tell us a bit more about the purpose of the Fed and what has recently changed and why that's such a big thing that a lot of people aren't really looking at?
Tom, I'm so glad you asked me because you're right. A lot of people aren't looking at it, and this is a real sea change. So here's the backstory in just a thumbnail sketch of the creation of the Federal Reserve. You know, the American people didn't want a central bank, a national bank, and Andrew Jackson had driven out. They all thought, you know, they were suspicious of highly centralized banking, things like that. So they knew that they couldn't, you know, the banking cartel knew they couldn't create a national U.S. national bank and get it through the people's approval or the approval of their representatives. So they came up with the Federal Reserve System. And they called it that. It was a very clever public relations campaign. It didn't just erupt one day. I mean, they planned this thing so carefully. And so they called it federal because they wanted to invoke, you know, national power of the United States from the Atlantic to the Pacific and, you know, the national might of the United States. So they called it federal. They called it a system because they knew it was a bank. It was a central bank. But they didn't dare try to go to the American people and say, hey, here's a new national central bank. You know, that we turn, so they called it a system instead. But the operative word, the real function that they used to sell this bank to the people and their elected representatives to get it through Congress was the reserve function. And the reserve function was simply this, that banks would keep a reserve. If they had, let's say, $100 million in deposits, they would keep $10 million on deposit, keep $10 million of that on reserve with the Federal Reserve, so that if there was a run on the bank, they could, in one region, one part of the country or another, you know, all that money could get bundled together and bail out that bank or that region and so on and stop bank panics. So that was the objective, to create a central reserve to protect the liquidity of the banking system. Last March, this was an enormous change. Last March, under the advance of the COVID pandemic and the lockdown, the Federal Reserve Board and Jerome Powell announced that the reserve function was being abolished. This is a move to massively increase liquidity. In other words, banks don't have to hold a reserve now. That was the whole rationale for the creation of the Fed to begin with, that there would always be a safety reserve to protect us, to protect depositors. And quietly, they slipped away from that in the middle of the night when people's concentration was on other things and nobody was paying attention. And they have completely eliminated the requirement that banks keep reserves. And of course, the reason for this is we've moved into a brave new world of money printing and modern monetary theory and stuff, that whatever the state wants to do, they can just make up the money. They can just print it. And so in my view, they have embarked on a strange new philosophy of money printing with eliminating the reserve, the thought being that why do we need a reserve to protect banks, to assure their liquidity like they did in the old days? Because if there's ever a problem, if there's ever a liquidity or solvency issue or a run on the banks, we'll just print the money, and they will. And so I think this is enormously significant, and I'm so glad you spotted that, because you're basically one of the few people that's talked about that.
Well, and you know, I couldn't do it without you bringing it up. You know, my research that I do before these programs helps me find these kind of things, but it's interesting that you were able to kind of pick that up. So I think this is a natural place to talk about the war on cash. So let's talk a little bit about how moving to a digital dollar, how that is actually, you know, destroying people's savings and what that's going to mean for the average person.
Yeah. And this is another thing that's going on at a speed that is almost astonishing. There was a report recently about by the Mises Institute about how fast, for example, the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund are advancing in creation of a worldwide central bank digital currencies. And it's going on here in the United States. It's on the drawing boards at the Fed. They're working on it. They're pushing it. And there are a couple of things at work here. I think one of the ones that may resonate most with your viewers is everybody knows about, you know, negative interest rates, that the Fed has been talking about negative interest rates. There's a huge amount of the bond portfolio now that bears negative interest rates. And people have to wonder, why would anybody turn money over to the bank or deposit money with the bank if they would pay you a negative rate? In other words, you put $100,000 in and then you go to pull your money out at the end of the year and they give you $950,000 back. Wait a minute, that's not how, so they're supposed to pay me to use my money for that year. But a negative interest rate says that they're not only are they not going to pay you to use your money, but they're going to charge you to put your money in the institution. And you think, well, then I'm not putting my money in the institution. Oh, yes, you are, because they're going to make you do it. So this is the war on cash. They've got to get rid of alternatives. As long as there are alternatives to their digital central bank, crypto money, blockchain wallet, Federal Reserve money, as long as there are alternatives, nobody's going to buy their negative interest rates. So they've got to get rid of cash. They've got to make cash as inconvenient as possible. They've got to put barriers on the use of cash. They've got to use the things like China's social credit system or something to stop people from using cash. One of the great opponents of cash has a recent book out called The War on Cash and talks about it's the job of the government to make the cash as inconvenient as possible so people won't use it. So, you know, the government's job isn't to serve the people in their needs, wants, and desires. The government's job, as they see it, is to drive the people like cattle to doing what the government geniuses say that we must all do. So negative interest rates require the elimination over time of the use on cash and the institutionalization of all financial transactions in the bank, in the system. One of the things the Fed's talking about is, you know, even a Federal Reserve account for everybody. Everybody has their own Federal Reserve account. But in any case, the other thing driving it besides negative interest rates and forcing people into the institutions is this impulse that the state has to surveil everything you do. And, you know, in America, the state was supposed to be an open book. We were supposed to be able to see everything that it does and watch everything. But that has changed. They don't want us to see anything. They invoke national security whenever they lie, cheat, and steal, you know, so that we can't see anything. And they got courts that help them protect them. But everything that we do is supposed to be an open book. So not only do they surveil your, you know, your internet communications and your telephone conversations, they store it all in Utah. And, you know, not only do they do that, but in addition to that, they will have, once they institutionalize the money with the new Fed central banking digital currency, then they will have access to every financial transaction that everybody makes. And that's kind of an objective of the totalitarian state as well.
And it seems like, you know, when they're doing all this money printing and stuff, there's a big lag between finding out how that money actually circulates in the economy. And one of the points that's been brought up before on the show was that if everything is digital, they can see exactly how the money ends up moving through the economy far quicker than, you know, the let's say analog version, right?
Yes, precisely. They can implement policy changes without delay, without resistance. They can change withholding rates, tax rates. If they wanted to flood the economy with worthless money, they can do it by making deposits into everybody's accounts in the middle of the night to devalue the existing currency. So they have complete carte blanche to do virtually everything and to do it all at once. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no time for resistance.
So, Charles, something that I think a lot of people, you know, really saw a lot of resistance to would be the moving towards modern monetary theory policies. So since the start of the pandemic, do you think that we've actually entered into this? And what are some signs of this?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was a time people would talk about modern monetary theory and it was like, oh, this is just taking to the next level all this Keynesian madness that you can spend your way to prosperity. And it's just taking it to the next level. And nobody can seriously believe this, that in fact, one of the bywords of the modern monetary theorists is anything the state wants, the state can afford. You know, this is a little bit absurd for those of us that work for a living that realize that that wealth is actually, you know, production. It's actually real things that people make, food they grow, services that people provide. If your doctor sees you, that's wealth. If the waitress gives you a ham and eggs in the morning and breakfast, that's work. That's real work. And the things that you buy at the store, these are all real things. And that's wealth. The number of green pieces of paper that they issue, that's not real wealth. But they believe that they can just basically print the money to pay for anything that they want, and there will be virtually no consequences of this. And I even have a couple of paragraphs about this in the book, about how many more of these kind of laboratory experiments in crazy monetary theory do we really need? I mean, where isn't it evident around the globe? You know, you probably remember the pictures that they took at night of the Korean Peninsula, and you would see, you know, South Korea below the line of demarcation was all illuminated at night, and you'd see where the cities were and the ports and stuff. And then you look at North Korea, and it's all plunged into darkness. We have that as a laboratory experiment. We have East Germany and West Germany. We have the collapse of the Soviet Union. We have what's going on in Venezuela right now. I mean, you know, do we really need to learn these same old lessons of banana republic money printing all over again? And the answer to that question is yes, apparently we do, because we're letting them get away with it. And so I actually believe that before COVID, modern monetary theory would have had a hard time being instituted, and it would have met some intellectual challenge and stuff. But in the panic of COVID, you know, the Fed printed $3 trillion in the middle of the night just to keep the government's doors open, and, started spending money, buying government debt, sending money. There, you know, prior to modern monetary theory, there was helicopter money. And the idea of helicopter money was, you know, if the Fed had to force money into the system, you know, the old question was, you know, what if the Fed's trying to inflate the economy and lend money, but borrowers like companies and corporations say, no, there's no market. You know, what, I'm going to borrow money from the Fed right now to build up my inventory when nobody's buying anything? What if they were trying to force money into the economy that way and there were no takers? And we've seen that happen. You know, conditions weren't ripe for people to borrow and expand their plant and equipment. So they scratched their head and they said, well, if we can't get money into the system that way, we'll just, you know, this is an analogy, but we'll just rent a helicopter and we'll fly around and drop the money off on people all over America, and that'll force money into the system. So they did a little of that with COVID, you know, and they're going to do a little of that with the next stimulus package. It's going to be, you know, $600 or $900 in everybody's account, and so on and so forth. But they've actually almost completely even bypassed that second stage of monetary corruption of helicopter money with modern monetary theory, and there don't seem to be any brakes on it. There doesn't seem to be any resistance in Congress or anybody, you know, saying you are really leading us to the last gold rush ever, in which, you know, people stand up, line up around the corners to buy gold with their paper money because they know what's going on with the paper money. And as I like to chide people that, you know, find these ideas difficult, I said, well, look, you know, nobody has ever stood in the line outside the bank demanding that the bank give them paper money for their gold. It's always the other way around. You know, people line up and they want gold for their paper money. Never, never do people line up to get paper money in exchange for their gold. Anyway, that's where we're headed once again here in the United States.
I think one of the best ways that you put that I've heard is that nobody's willing to trade Venezuelan, is it bolivars, for any gold. Like, it doesn't matter how many you have, nobody's going to trade it for a piece of gold, right?
And you know, Tom, just recently, I think just a couple of weeks ago, Venezuela just ordered 7 tons of high quality currency printing stock from an Italian paper producer. So, and I think, why bother? You could just use what you've got left and just add a lot more zeros on the end, you know? But I mean, this is such an old and familiar and worn process. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it makes me feel good, because when I say, you know, Venezuela's printing money by the tons, you know, it's literally true now.
So, Charles, I think A natural kind of question that comes up when we're talking about MMT policies and this massive money printing and stuff, you would think that this would be inflationary for the currency, right? But during the pandemic, we've seen these certain deflationary forces at work to kind of counteract that, let's say. So at what point do you think one of these two forces is going to win, and what is the outcome of that in your opinion?
Yeah, this is always like Godzilla versus King Kong or something. These two mighty forces.
They seem somewhat balanced right now, right?
Yeah, they get to a little bit of a standoff, and then somebody gets an edge. My view is pretty simplistic about it. The government is always trying to inflate conditions. This is what governments do. They are always trying to inflate. And the motivations for doing that are many. Elected officials, presidents, you know, they like to say, oh, they come out with economic reports about how your home price is going up and wages are going up and so on and so forth. So they always have an impulse to inflate conditions. They want to buy things. The elected officials want to buy things that they don't want to tax the people to pay for. So they always want to inflate. And the market, you know, senses these dislocations, these bubbles as they're developing, and the market always tries to deflate and to return to some sort of a normalcy. So these bubbles always pop, and the popping of the bubbles is the deflation, and the blowing up of the bubbles is the inflationary period. So yeah, you know, with Americans by the millions, you know, having lost their jobs and their livelihood and having to be sustained by freshly printed money and so on, with people out of work, restaurants shutting down, all of this stuff too, by the way, hasn't even been explored, the impact of all of this as it cascades through the economy. You know, the waiter loses his job because the restaurant closes. The restaurant closes, so the mall operator can't make his payment. The mall operator can't pay the pension fund. The mall developer can't pay the pension fund that loaned him the money to build the mall. The pension fund then can't pay the retirees and so on. And so nobody is really, in my view, looking at just how all of this cascades and the ultimate accounting for this period of shutdown that we have been through. But the Fed is a one-trick pony. And the one trick is, no matter what the problem is, we will answer it with money printing. And, you know, this is as evident as anything. And so there are immediate consequences of businesses being closed. And all these are deflationary. People seeing their bank accounts drained as they struggle to survive. All of these things are deflationary. And the Fed rides to the rescue and used to be, you know, throwing out, you know, maybe helicopter money, but in this case, it rides to the rescue and it starts modern monetary theory and printing money willy-nilly. And for them, this is the real problem, is that sometimes they're aware of what they're doing, but there's no other alternative. I mean, I wrote a piece for one of my clients recently about, well, what would you do? And I looked back at, the central bankers of Germany during the great Weimar inflation. You know, what were they supposed to do? They were supposed to let the economy collapse. Well, they didn't want to do that. So they printed money until the economy collapsed. And, you know, what are they going to do in Venezuela? Well, they don't want the economy collapse. Well, it's already collapsed, but they've got to do something. So they only have one trick. So they print money. And so that's where we are right now. And the money printing, I think, is horrendous as it has been. Has not yet entered the consumer economy, and people don't have an idea how fast prices will begin to rise as it is assimilated in the economy this coming year.
Mm-hmm. So in the event of, let's say, once we get crazy inflation and the confidence in the dollar really starts to crash, tell us a little bit about, you know, again, the subtitle of your book is how to profit from it, right? So, If there's a run on the banks and there's no more confidence in the dollar, let's talk about the best forms of gold as an insurance policy and maybe touch on some of the pieces of, you know, having counterparty risk of holding something like an ETF.
Yeah. So this is, ETFs serve a good purpose and gold stocks serve a good purpose and they provide wonderful leverage in the right time. we're talking about a kind of an end game event here. So we're talking about something a little different, and gold is a wonderful way to profit. And there are different channels that are appropriate for people, but we're talking about a fundamental change in the nature of the dollar. So it's not just like another bull market, as we've said. You know, this is there has to be a change in the dollar as presently constituted. The strains on it, the tension on it, the unsustainability of it as it is, can't continue. And so we're talking about a period in which counterparty risk proliferates. And Warren Buffett once said, it's not until, you know, the tide goes out that you see who's been swimming naked. And this is true. And I mean, you know, if it hadn't been for the, you know, the stock market calamity in 2008, 2009, Bernie Madoff may still be running his flim-flam, you know, but the tide went out and the weakest people start getting exposed and stuff. And then people withdraw money from the weakest people and pretty soon Bear Stearns collapses and so on and so forth. And it starts to ratchet up through the economy. So we're talking about a period in which no representation of wealth can be relied upon. And it's not to say that everybody's a crook. It's not to say that everybody's a liar that issues anything, but gold has one virtue that no other monetary unit has. And that is, it is absolutely its own value. It is not dependent on the issuer. An ounce of gold doesn't really care ultimately whose picture is on it, what government issued it, where it's held. If it's held in your hand, it's an ounce of gold, and it has the value of an ounce of gold, regardless of accounting procedures that can be like Bernie Madoff's and make misrepresentations or mistakes, natural disasters that can hit, government actions that can try to grab and monetize resources to nationalize resources like mines and stuff. Gold has no counterparty risk. It is not dependent on anybody else's representations. And you don't want to have to rely on a monetary unit like that. You want to live in a society in which you can trust people and trust institutions and trust businesses and stuff. But the rot comes from the top down. When the monetary system is itself corrupted, everybody all the way down the line is corrupted along with it. And so we think this is a very, very good time to protect yourself with the only form of money that is not dependent on somebody else's performance, because all of those things will become very wobbly in the next couple of years.
So Charles, in your opinion, is the only real way to, let's say, capture that value, that store of value, is in physical gold, not necessarily mining shares or, like I said, these ETFs?
Yeah. In the case that we're talking about, the last gold rush ever, it is absolutely physical gold that you can lay your hands on. So it's not titled to gold. It's not, you know, I used to ask for, when I was doing commentary with Ron Paul, we used to, you know, talk about auditing the Fed or auditing the America's gold at Fort Knox, for example. And, you know, some cynic would say, well, what do you think, Charles? You think somebody backed up a pickup truck in the middle of the night and drove off with the gold? No, it's not a question of just inventorying the gold, counting the bars. It's a question of how badly the title has been compromised over the years, whether it has been lent, used to secure other transactions, used to secure trades with foreign governments for other currency issuance, whether it's been hypothecated, rehypothecated, pledged. And so a real audit isn't just counting the bars, but it's finding out, you know, how clear the title is. Well, with the gold that you own in your own possession in a disruptive period like this, all of those things don't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, your gold is your gold, and it doesn't matter. You know, if you own it, it hasn't been pledged to somebody else. It's not an entry on a ledger, on a balance sheet. It's not shown as an asset that may or may not be there or may be nationalized tomorrow. So, yes, and I like to emphasize that there are wonderful opportunities to make money in gold and silver, and wonderful opportunities to do things with shares, and wonderful opportunities to do things with ETFs. But there's nothing like having real, actual, physical gold in a monetary crisis when they're changing the nature of the paper money as the dollar will change in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm.
So, Charles, one of the last questions I wanted to ask you was that you've authored two other books, one called Red, White, or Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. I wanted to get that right, as you said, that nobody gets it right. Red, Blue, and Broke All Over, and also The Dollar Meltdown. So how have these books held up, and maybe some of the lessons that are still applicable today that you could share with us?
Yeah. So Red and Blue and Broke All Over is really a condemnation of the political process as we see it. It tries to make the point, I think most people are aware of this now, may not have been in 2011 when it came out, that the problem of deficits, the problem of overextension of the American military empire, the problem of the declining middle class in America and cronyism is not the work of the Red Party or the Blue Party. But they're both in it together. And you don't want to see how ugly things are at night when they get together and start divvying up the crony rewards and stuff. So it was basically about that. And that anybody that thought that they could change, you know, the Red Party for the Blue or the Blue for the Red and have a fundamental reform and restore the American middle class and end the cronyism was mistaken. And I think I illuminated that pretty well. And The Dollar Meltdown that came out in, it was issued in 2009. I wrote in The Dollar Meltdown about things that are a little bit of in advance of where we are today. So what happens when you get into one of these really highly inflationary periods? What happens when, the American housewife is complaining on your TV late news that she can't, you know, the grocery budget doesn't stretch that far anymore? When everybody's up in arms, when they're talking about having meat boycotts like they had in the 70s because prices are too high. And I walk through this age-old process of the government having created the problem in the first place, that they'll ride to the rescue and fix it. So if prices are rising too fast because of what they did with monetary inflation, they say, well, that's okay. We'll come fix it and we'll impose wage and price controls and we'll freeze the problem. So they freeze prices, and the result of that is, of course, predictable, and that means shortages, and the store shelves empty, and you go to the store, and there are nice low prices on all the food and stuff, but the shelves are empty, and there's no meat, even though the price is really nice and low. So the government, now having created this additional problem, says, oh, well, we'll fix that, and so they institute a reign of rationing, and then problems get really bad. And wealth gets destroyed at a faster pace. And this provides an opportunity for the growth of the government to unimaginable. This, you know, is the man on a white horse syndrome, you know, when things get that bad. So the dollar meltdown was a little bit about those sorts of things. And I wrote in there that the recommendations and the things I talk about in this book are only good for this year, next year, and the year after. So roughly through 2011, which turned out to be pretty good because both gold and silver exploded during that period. But I said, the important thing about this book is that I've wandered through all these economic precedents so that you will learn from them and be able to understand. I haven't written much in the last gold rush ever about what will happen when we get deep into this and the kind of emergency measures that the state will implement, like wage and price controls and like rationing. I haven't written about that in this book. This is basically about how all these accelerants come together to change the nature of the dollar. And you'll have to figure that out once it hits. But it basically says your safe haven during that period is to own gold and to own physical gold. But yes, there is another part of the story, and that is during the depths of this crisis. Look, there are people running around right now, Tom, and say, well, if we get in a crisis like that, you know, then the International Monetary Fund will arrive on the scene with their special drawing rights and we'll have a new currency. And I scratch my head and I think the people having been fleeced by one made-up, unbacked currency are going to trust another made-up, unbacked currency of some multinational organization that nobody really understands to replace it. And I think that they won't. And the wise among the people will protect themselves with physical gold and silver. And it may be that the state, you know, turns to the special drawing right of the IMF, or they come up with some new, you know, Rube Goldberg device, but it won't be real money. And it's not real money unless you can go to the bank or go to the treasury and say, here, and they give you your gold for it.
Absolutely, Charles. And I think one of the interesting, let's say, pieces that I've I heard you talk about on another program there was in the idea that red or blue, the monetary policy is really the same. So I think you were telling me before the call that the Treasury Secretary ended up being the same for no, it didn't matter if it was Republican or Democrat, right?
Sure. It's the truth. And they all were coming from Goldman Sachs. And now they're going to come from another major Wall Street firm in the Biden administration, but it's basically, you know, interchangeable parts. But even I think the best way to illustrate this is people think that there's, you know, there are two warring parties with completely different philosophies and stuff in Washington, and they duke it out and stuff. And it's simply not the case. And the best example, you look at the Federal Reserve. You know, you had, the longest serving chairman of the Federal Reserve was Alan Greenspan, and he was appointed by Ronald Reagan. And then he was reappointed by Bush the Elder. And then he was reappointed by Bill Clinton. And then I think he was probably reappointed by Bush the Younger. But in any case, Bush, so that, you know, you can see you're going from a Republican to a Democrat to a Republican, appointing the same guy with the same philosophy. And the same thing happened with Ben Bernanke. He was appointed by George W. Bush, and then he was reappointed by Barack Obama. And now, Tom, Biden has already identified his new Treasury Secretary, and it's Janet Yellen, who was a terribly failed chairman of the Federal Reserve. So there is one policy, there is one monetary policy for the United States under Republicans and under Democrats, and it doesn't change. And it's, well, it changes to the extent that it degrades over time. And so while it used to be Keynesianism, we'll spend our way to prosperity, and then it was, you know, maybe we can implement helicopter money. And now it's modern monetary theory, but it's all the idea that the Fed actually creates value, creates real wealth by creating paper money. And it's a fraud, and people all over the world have been victimized by this stuff going back to Kublai Khan. I mean, it's just so old, it's so tired, and yet we have to relearn the same lessons over and over and over again. Anyway, this one's coming like a runaway freight. You see all the signs of it today. The biggest signs of it, of course, are the changing of the dollar status internationally. And I think you'll know that, you know, when they're not willing to fund our debt. Ron Paul once said, you know, I think we're going to be in trouble. If the United States ever gets in a difficult jam, we will find ourselves bereft of help. You know, that we've been arrogant and pushed our way around the rest of the world for so long now that we'll be astonished at how much resentment there is against some of the things the United States wants to do. And we're starting to see that now. And so if we do get into an economic crisis, we can't look to the rest of the world to keep holding dollars. They're going to bail out so fast it'll make your head spin. And they've already begun to do so.
Well, that's kind of a depressing note to wrap up here on, Charles. Is there anything else you'd like to add today?
Well, we hope that you'll enjoy the book. It is a deep dive into all of these things. And we talk about the trade and currency wars and the way that they serve as an accelerant for the last gold rush ever. We talk about the war on cash that we visited, the ending of the New World Order and American hegemony. The ending of the global military empire is a huge one, and I watch it with astonishment unfolding every day. But I think you'll find that that if you read this book, you'll be able to read the signs of the times and just how far along we are and when the flashpoints are about to hit. And that was our purpose in the book.
And of course, we can find more information about you at charlesgoyette.com, right?
Yeah, you betcha.
Perfect. Thanks very much for your time today, Charles.
Tom, it was a great conversation. I'm so appreciative. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.